Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Thomas Dyges' book, New York, New York, New York, Four Decades of Success, Excess, and Transformation, isn't a straight history. It's more of an analysis of people and policy and the intersection of the two and how that's changed and shaped New York. Who are the people? Well, you, me, someone's grandma who's been here since 1940, us New Yorkers, and the changing definition of New Yorker over time based on immigration and shifting demographics. The policy? The plans of various leaders of this city and how each approached their goals, be it Koch, Dinkins, Giuliani, or Bloomberg. The themes explored in the book are the outgrowth of the behavior, desires, needs, and wants of average New Yorkers as well as power brokers, as well as, of course, the impact of unforeseen events like terrorist attacks and acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. Here's a description of the time period the book covers, quote, "After brutal retrenchment came the dazzling Koch Renaissance and the Dinkins years that left the city's liberal traditions battered but laid the foundation for the safe streets and dot-com excess of Giuliani's reformation in the 90s. Then the planes hit on 9/11. The shaky city handed itself over to Bloomberg, who merged City Hall into his personal empire, launching its reimagination." Dyges makes the case that New York City passed through a renaissance, reformation, and a reimagining from the late 70s to now. And the book is particularly interesting in this moment when post-COVID-19, the city might have to add another R word to its history. Maybe recalibrate. Let's talk about all of this with Thomas Dyges. Dyges is the author of three novels, as well as the biography of civil rights pioneer Walter White and the book The Third Coast, When Chicago Built the American Dream. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So I want to get a baseline understanding for our listeners about these three eras, Renaissance, Reformation, and Reimagination. What time period are we talking about for each? And how did you arrive at these three words, Renaissance, Reformation, and Reimagination?
Right. That kind of made sense. You know, the time period really begins with the fiscal crisis, kind of when Koch takes over in 78. And it goes through the Bloomberg years to 2018, which is when I started the book. It seemed to me to be a very discrete period in time in New York, when it started in this very, very dark place and with this long arc towards a city that kind of consistently got bigger and stronger, cleaner, but also darker in many other ways. So, but it wasn't a kind of straight passage. You know, there were major ups and downs, moments when you thought, oh, well, here's a new city. So it kind of broke into these three paths, these three parts of the era of Koch and Dinkins, which had its own kind of path of up and down, which was that could have been retrenchment. That was another R word that was at the beginning. But in a lot of ways, it was a renaissance. The city began to look at itself in a newer, stronger way after the 70s. The next part was Giuliani, when he takes it over, and really it is a kind of reformation. I could have called that restoration, because so much of that period is about kind of going back to the past. People talk about the Disneyfication of Times Square, and in a certain way, the whole city had a very, it kind of looked back to the past, whether it was real or imagined past, that's debatable. And then the third part is the Bloomberg years, which were a kind of reimagining, even though a lot of the ideas and a lot of the personnel were people who had been with Koch and had pulled these ideas all the way through. So it seemed to me one unit of history that seemed like it was going to change. I think you're right that we are really on the doorstep now, though, of a fourth R, which I haven't quite decided what it is yet, because we don't know.
I want to quote a very funny line from the New York Times review of the book. The reviews have been spectacular for this book. It's very positive, but each reviewer has taken a different idea about something you wrote. And in the New York Times, the reviewer conceded, quote, "This is a good book to argue with." So I'm curious how you decided to handle the flexibility of memory when writing a book like this.
Right. I mean, I think it cuts to the core of it. It was one of the reasons why I think I started the book. In 2013 was the discourse of the city was, I think, very binary, and it remains so. But a lot of it came from this place of of remembering and nostalgia and the sense of a city that had been lost. And I wanted to examine that and kind of look into that. How much of that was real? How much of that was about the city? And how much of that was about our own selves? How much our sense of mortality? You know, because when I look back running around downtown in 1980, sure, I was 19, you know, and for people who maybe were living in other ways in other parts of the city, it wasn't quite as much of a playground as I might have thought it was. And so my own kind of reconsideration of that, I think, led to me to try to think about how we look at the whole city and how we kind of look back and get past the memories and try to lay down some real markers as to what happened and try to really understand the people who made the change in the city, the events that made it, that maybe we're not familiar with. Maybe people who had an enormous impact, like Gordon Davis in the Parks Department, mm-hmm. Or the community organizers, you know, the Gwendolyn, you know, Brooks in the Bronx, and, you know, Reverend Youngblood and Mike Geekin in Brooklyn, people who maybe aren't headline people, but who had an enormous impact on the city, and kind of cut through the romance with some reality in that way.
Yeah, I was wondering how you battled nostalgia.
Yeah, nostalgia's fun, you know. I mean, one of the things I did was really read every New York magazine from 1978 on, which was just to not get the headlines, but to see what we remember, really, what we were wearing, what were the movies that were out, what were the things that were happening at any moment, what was the kind of atmosphere of the place. And that was a wonderful corrective for me, because things weren't necessarily always the way I remembered them. Often they weren't, you know. And it was still fun, though, to be able to take a certain step back. And you know, hindsight's always terrific, but it is also what history is, to sort of be able to start to create through lines from that and be able to get that awful, horrible sense of things creeping towards reality, as in, say, former president and most famous New Yorker, who is a sort of figure throughout it, that being Trump, you know, and sort of seeing how that evolves over that. That is a way of kind of going back through those memories and creating narratives from it that I think were kind of tragic.
My guest is Thomas Dyja. The name of the book is New York, New York, New York, Four Decades of Success, Excess, and Transformation. So you begin by writing about the sad state of public spaces 40 years ago, and it really kind of says a lot about the city's health and even sort of the city's mental health.
Yeah.
As you say, New Yorkers need to see the city and their fellow citizens as something more than adversaries, and that's why parks mattered so much. Why had public spaces become so unusable?
Yeah, a lot of there was a real sense, I think, that there was a wonderful quote in the Times early in the book where a guy is interviewed and he says, you know, this is like late 70s. And he says, well, there's such a sense that you can't make anything good that you just do your part to make it a little worse, you know, and there was a kind of basic sense of living in nature, you know, and not in a good way, a kind of antagonistic sense of using space. And so people like Gordon Davis, who I mentioned before, mm-hmm. who really used the parks as a way to help us rethink public space. Holly White, the urbanist, was a great impact on a lot of people in that kind of public space discussion under Koch and all the way through. And he felt that cities existed to help people exchange. And the answer to fixing a city, to helping it back to health, was helping people fill the streets. And so public space needed to be not a place where kind of anything went, you know, where you just did what you wanted to, but where it was a place where, in that kind of Frederick Law Olmsted understanding of it, that public space was a place where we exercise democracy, where we could have some shared behaviors that we understand, here's what the things we can do. And with that understanding, let's each do our thing together. And so parks became a kind of laboratory for that mindset. And I think when you think of the wonder that people had when even something like the Sheep Meadow finally was, you know, taken from a dust bowl and turned into this big grassy field, it was amazing. People really just went there and took their shoes off and put their feet in grass and were stunned by it. And there were those who thought, oh, this is terribly suburban, you know, but people loved it. They thought there's another possibility for how we could live in the city that isn't necessarily about running back home after the day and locking the door. And that added, I think it helped revitalize the idea of what urban life could be in a very good way. I think some of those ideas were later weaponized into kinds of forms of control under Giuliani. But initially, that was kind of one of the reasons I wanted to do the book. These seemed such wonderful ideas But by the time we were at the end of Bloomberg, I think they were discussed in these purely kind of control ways. And they kind of got a bad name from that.
You know, it's interesting. Gordon Davis, he's one of my favorite people in Hollywood. They're also just sort of interesting people. Like they have just a sort of a certain amount of charisma and a certain amount of energy around them. When you were writing the book, I was sort of curious because people kept popping out to me as much as the politics of the moment. How much of it is about leadership, about personality, even if you're not necessarily an elected official?
Well, there's a sense of New York loves to feel that someone's in charge. They don't want to be told what to do, but they want to know that someone's watching the ship, you know, mm-hmm. and taking care of things. And I think on a macro level, I think that's really important. The leaders who made themselves clear that they were leaders, I think, were able to achieve the most and let people kind of get to their own thing. But on a lower level or kind of local level, people assuming a sense of their own possible leadership is one of the very important threads of the book, I think. Mm-hmm. One of the things that bothered me and still does is that kind of, you know, Twitter warrior, this sense of passivity, of things being done to us, you know, these great conspiracies that destroyed New York while we were standing helplessly by. And the fact is, for good and bad, we were all players in it. And I wanted to highlight many of the people who did amazing things. Again, these community organizers, Larry Kramer, hip hop people, you know, artists who created great kinds of communal artworks. I mean, there's all kinds of examples of people who said, you know, I think I want to do something. And Larry Kramer has a wonderful quote about picking up pieces of paper, and leadership comes from just you start to pick up one day, and then you pick up another, and pretty soon you have power. The power comes in the action. And so I wanted the book to be a kind of, you know, it is history, it is narrative history, but it is hopefully a call to action for people to realize that they are active players in the city. And they're able to flex, and they can make change, and they have. And that's one of the ways the city got to where it got.
My guest is Thomas Dyja. We're talking about the book, New York, New York, New York. I do want to talk about leaders a little bit. You know, if you look at all the obituaries of Ed Koch, the words brash and outspoken were the adjectives most likely used.
Yeah.
So how does Koch and his style of governing fit into your thesis that during his time as mayor, there was a renaissance or a revival of some sort of the city?
Right. I mean, listen, renaissances are not just, you know, the art looks great, but we also have to remember that a lot of people got stabbed during them, you know, so they're kind of bloody. They're very creative, but they're bloody periods. And the same is true of this period where Koch's sense of exuberance, his sense of pride in New York was there latently. And as the city was kind of teetering from the fiscal crisis, there was this upswelling of re-examination. Oh, we actually love this place. We don't hate New York. It isn't all taxi driver. We're gonna try to love this city. And Koch really helped people come back to that. At the same time, he also drove a very deep wedge racially in the city. Mm-hmm. And I think to his credit, later in his life, I think he re-examined that and tried to publicly show his understanding of the mistakes he made at places like Sydenham Hospital, other cases like that. But it was a period where communities, certainly the black community, that had always traditionally kind of had a role in government by fiat, that was part of the power sharing understanding, found themselves completely out of the situation. And that, and Koch actively played on that and created divisions racially. And so that is a terrible legacy of Koch at the same time. But on a purely administrative level, to close, he did something that I think Bloomberg also did very well with, which is that he did bring in experts. He brought in people who were able to do jobs and said, you do the job, I'll provide the, you know, the political cover, but do the thing that's right for New York. And not in every case, but in many, many cases, they did. If you're going to bring in experts, you got to let them do what they're going to do and not overly politicize it, I think.
You know, days after Ed Koch died, the New York Times had to go back and change its obit to include more about his poor handling of the AIDS crisis. They wrote a 5,000-word obit, and I think it originally only mentioned AIDS once. Mm. One, I'm curious what you make of that as someone who had to go back and reread a lot of news coverage. And how did that failure shape this city?
Well, you know, he really, and it's, I've had, you know, questions about that. I mean, I think many I'm not gay, but many gay friends, and was certainly working in entertainment during these years, mm-hmm. so kind of understood and was around the AIDS crisis. And Koch was understood by many, most, to be gay. I mean, it was sort of as we look back at that first mayoral race with the vote for Cuomo, not the homo signs that were around, was pretty horrifying. Mm-hmm. So it was a kind of something that was discussed at the time. And so Koch's position on it was very bitter, you know, that he did not really want to pay attention to it. It's odd when you look at the mayor's reports, the mayor's annual reports that had to be done. There was, you know, very, very little attention being paid way along into what was a public crisis. So the city got off the beat very slowly on AIDS at the place that was really the epicenter, the kind of the ground zero for that crisis. I have to say, would it have, so many people were operating without knowledge and not understanding that it's hard to say that he had any greater knowledge that he ignored, but it would have been important to have activated the city. It would have been important to work with much more the gay community and figuring out what had to happen just to get a greater need on it, a greater focus on it, and put more money to it faster would have made, I think, an enormous difference.
After Ed Koch, of course, came David Dinkins, the city's first and only black mayor. There has to be more to David Dinkins' legacy than he was the only black mayor. When you think about his lasting imprint on the city, what is something that has outlasted his time as mayor?
Times Square. Even though Giuliani takes all the credit for it, you know, and certainly jumped up. It was made very clear to me by people who worked on it that he did not, you know, he was not involved. The real groundwork for that was done under Dinkins. He was the one who signed the agreement with Disney, think what you will about it, but it was part of a longer kind of rethinking of what Times Square could be. You know, he had to survive peak AIDS, peak crack, peak crime. And he really did lay the groundwork for it. After that horrifying murder of Brian Watkins, the family, the young man from Utah who had come to the U.S. Open, that sense of the city, again, you know, the cover of Time, Dave, do something, the rotten apple. There was another sense of crisis that the city will never come back. And he did get the New York Police Department to re-examine themselves and put through the law, the Safe Streets, Safe Kids law that really brought the money in, that laid the groundwork, put new officers on the street that Giuliani also was able to take credit for. So a lot of the groundwork was laid during those years, but I think he was very hard time communicating the sense that he was in charge, that there was leadership involved. And, you know, some of his own best impulses left him being someone who seemed indecisive and spent a lot of time trying to come to a decision and didn't really express or couldn't really show people that he kind of understood what their day-to-day was like. At the same time, he faced a remarkable amount of racism. I mean, one of the things that was really shocking to me going back and reading newspapers and magazines from the time was the way he was written about at that point was just remarkable and jaw-dropping. The attitude, the kind of racism underlying it is stunning to me at this point. And so I think he was up against a lot more than just events.
My guest is Thomas Dyja. The name of the book is New York, New York, New York, Four Decades of Success, Excess, and Transformation. We'll continue the conversation with a discussion. We'll talk about immigrants, what happens to neighborhoods when, as Thomas writes, people wanted bohemian cachet without bohemian poverty. And yes, we'll talk about Rudy after the break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest is Thomas Dyja. His book is New York, New York, New York, Four Decades of Success, Excess, and Transformation. And as you mentioned, Thomas, there's so many great people that you profile in this book. You write about the four women who changed 42nd Street, DJ Kool Herc. There's all kinds, but you write about real New Yorkers as well. And immigrants, I found that so interesting about the influx of immigrants and how it profoundly changed the city in the past 40 years. What did it mean for New Yorkers who were already here, the haves and the have-nots, this huge influx of immigrants?
Well, it's more, you know, influx. That's what saved the city fundamentally. We can talk about all the great political policies and capital and Wall Street and all kind of stuff, but adding 1.5 million people who are mostly immigrants to the country really, you know, changes the economy, opens up the culture. When we look at what made New York such a vital place to be, an exciting new place to be in these years, so much of it came from this generation of immigrants coming to the city. I don't think we can in any way overestimate it. So, you know, it changed the map in so many ways. You know, there are other ways, kind of general neighborhood changing is not always gentrification. People moving all through different parts of the city, different nationalities or ethnicities giving way to others, rewrote the map in all kinds of ways. And so I think we really have to look to immigration as being the heart of the story, really. So I wanted to look at that, not just in to add that to the story, you know, to make sure that it was part of when we look over these years, we don't just talk about Wall Street and we don't just talk about neoliberalism, but we really look at what immigrants brought to the table, what other people in the city brought to the table to create it. And they are a major piece of the economy, and we need immigration.
It was interesting to read about neighborhoods becoming part of people's identities.
Yeah.
That the naming of neighborhoods, when did that become a thing and why? Why did it stick? I'm sort of interested.
Naming neighborhoods is a fascinating kind of real estate story, right? And it happens in every city. Has, you know, I grew up in Chicago, and there are neighborhoods that I have no idea what they are because they've been renamed. And we look at New York, it happens all the time. But I do think the identity was very one of the most telling examples of that is in the late 70s, 60s and 70s, as the Bronx is burning and, kind of turned into the South Bronx, all these neighborhoods that existed, and Morrisania, Plato, Tremont, those names start to disappear, and it's just called the South Bronx, you know, in this ominous, horrible way, right? And then in Brooklyn, a whole area that was largely known as South Brooklyn for much of its life suddenly becomes Borough Hill and Cairo Gardens and is kind of divvied up in these mostly just realtor names that helped people create an identity with it. And I think it very concurrent with the rise of what I think of is lifestyle. Very consciously living in the city, and Soho had a real role in that, I think, as people started to imagine this way of living, you know, and how you lived in the city became a kind of commodity. It wasn't just about buying a house to live in a place and have a school nearby and a, you know, grocery store close by. It became a certain ineffable value that had a lot to do with the past. It had to do with how your place looked and its history. All these things kind of boiled into lifestyle. And that starts to become something that spreads around the city and is kind of the lubrication of gentrification fundamentally.
Let's talk about the last section, Reformation. It starts with a chapter titled More Like the Rest of America. Mm-hmm. And it starts with the inauguration of Rudy Giuliani. How did Rudy contribute to making New York City more like the rest of America? Something I'm not sure the average New Yorker would think is such a great idea.
Yes, in some ways, you know, listen, I remember looking for a hardware store, you know, and they were hard to find. If you remember when Bed Bath & Beyond opened and mm-hmm. seeing like a wall of towels and things and going, oh my God, you know, look at that. And it's cheap. You know, there were things that New York was very peculiar about, certainly Manhattan, and changes like allowing in big box retail were at the initially fabulous. Oh my goodness, look, you know, we have these things here that we never had in New York. But of course, like so many things in the book, wonderful ideas are taken and allowed to become permanent. And so the city ends up being retail space, gets overwhelmed by it. But for Rudy, I think that in the overall sense, that more like America thing was, about how we lived and what the expectation was, that it was a bit more homogenous, that difference was not celebrated as much as it was kind of looked askance at. And that was a real step away from what we were used to, I think, in New York. And technology also played a role in that. And the internet, as time went by and that became something that people accessed more, frankly, you didn't have to come to New York from other parts of the United States to kind of be that person and, you know, fly that freak flag the way you might have in the 60s or 70s, where you had to come to New York to be that person. Suddenly, you could find those affinities online. And New York had a little bit drained away from it in that way, while the rest of the world, the rest of America, got a little bit more New York, I think.
What is something that was a fun fact? In fact, I didn't realize Giuliani was the person who let the big box stores in. That was such an interesting moment in the book.
Dinkins kind of lays the way in there little. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of expand a little bit, but Giuliani's like 200,000 square feet, whatever. Let's bring him in. It was part of the whole thing.
So, you know, the Rudy Giuliani that we see today, what do you see in the Rudy of today that you believe from your research and your reporting has been there the whole time? And then what is something you see in Rudy Giuliani today that feels really foreign, like something has shifted in him dramatically?
I think what shifted is, I mean, he's always been incredibly cagey and that. You know, very scary man who, you know, who wants control, you know, that kind of being on top of it all, but also really working from an in place more than you would think. I mean, this is a man who got on television and publicly announced his divorce to his wife, who didn't know he was going to divorce her. You know, I mean, he did kind of off kilter things, but he really has even that jumped the rails, I think. I'm surprised. Usually those things had a very calculated aspect to them. And where I think he's gotten to now is really somewhat uncontrolled. I just think he's out there swinging as opposed to before, when I think he had a plan. And to his credit, and this is something I really wanted to do in the book, was go through these lives and give credit where credit was due. He did provide leadership, not just at, you know, during 9/11 and afterwards for that short period of time, but he did walk in the door after what was a fairly loosey-goosey administration to some degree, and bring in some order to it in ways that I think were positive, and try to lay the groundwork for the kind of data analysis that the time really called for, because it was available. And it's your job to kind of bring tech to bear on the city.
And I do want to ask you for a final question. This is a show about arts and culture and our culture in and around New York. And towards the very end of the book, you write, "The arts are also necessary for the urban soul, and the next New York will need culture as a uniting force amid a shattering world." You go on to say, "Going forward, keeping New York a place where artists can and want to live and nurturing the arts in our communities will matter more to the city's long-term health than feeding the global art market." Mm-hmm. I'm curious why you wrote that.
Because I think we need to be producing art here and not just selling it. And that's not just a hearkening back to kind of the romance of the 70s or the 80s with downtown artists. I mean, we do, because we are a central place, we are a kind of great urban swamp of ideas for the world. We need to not just be selling art. We need people to be engaging each other and producing it again. And some of that's just a practical matter of affordability. That's why housing matters. We need people who are young, who can worry more about creating than having to like pay that 50% of income for their rent. So I think we need that. We don't necessarily need islands in the Hudson. I think we need young people with ideas getting ready for this next generation and this new R, whatever it's going to be, for the fourth evolution of the city.
The name of the book is New York, New York, New York, Four Decades of Success, Excess, and Transformation. Thomas Dija, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.